You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel?
The Goo Goo Dolls. On a Wednesday. Yeah, John Bolton, back in public. And so following John Bolton here on the program is our Pacific Rim expert, Grant Newsham, who's in a euphoric state as the descendants of the Washington Senators triumphed last night in dramatic fashion. So first of all, Grant, congratulations on the big win last night. You fired up to go face the Dodgers now?
Yeah. How's the sound here?
Wait, say that again?
How's the sound?
The sound sounds fine. Thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm just getting a little whatever feedback, but that's good. Yeah, I am. I've been taking early my money out of my IRA early. Put it all on the Senators this year. I'm telling you, this is going to work.
You know, in all seriousness, the Senators have been plagued by just catastrophe after catastrophe in the playoffs. And honestly, to see them doing okay, I mean, the game starts with a guy who is like 1-for-20 against Max Scherzer. What's his name? Last name's Grandal. He hits a 2-run home run. There's nobody out, and they're already down. And you're like, oh my God, here it goes again. And yet they have more comeback wins than anybody else in Major League Baseball, and they did it again in dramatic fashion, thanks to a ball that kicked on the right fielder. But such is life. But there is nothing like, I think, the drama of the pitch-to-pitch drama. Agony of playoff baseball, and it was in full view last night in the nation's capital. So, do you have your hat on? Do you have your T-shirt on? You all geared up?
No. I was. There is a limit, but and since I'm in Taiwan, I thought I would read about it in the on the internet afterwards. But yeah, if anybody is going to empty out their IRA early and put it on the Nationals, please don't. There's still a long way to go.
I know, but hope springs eternal this morning. And yeah. You know what? Good. It's better than it's better than the other outcomes. Big stuff going on. First of all, we need to get our GPS out. Where are you right now? Are you in Taipei?
I'm back in Taipei. Nice and it was hot as hell, and now it's kind of like back to normal. So it's actually better than it was last time you talked to me.
All right. Is it what time of the year? Is it fall there? Do they participate in our seasons, or are they on a different set?
Yeah, it would be. That's what it's like. It'd be about like, what would it be like? It's not as cold as D.C., and it's not like Southern California. But it's got four seasons. So it just, it seems, yeah, I can't quite think of what to compare it to. You get seasons, so you don't get like freezing cold and snow and that sort of thing. But it gets good and cool during the winter.
Got it.
Maybe almost cold, but nothing, Minnesota-like.
What is the top news story today in the newspapers of Taiwan?
Oh boy, that's a good question. It always seems to kind of be the same. There's a particularly local politics where they have an election coming in January that'll be for president, and the incumbent, a lady named Madam Tsai, is very good. She's would like to keep Taiwan free, and she's obviously walking a tightrope. And then you have the opposition, which is called the KMT, the old Kuomintang, which was Chiang Kai-shek's party originally. But it's the opposition, and they are actually considered almost willing to cut a deal with China, sort of give up sovereignty, give up freedom. Some would say independence or de facto independence. And that's the sort of the choice, is someone who wants to keep things as they are, keep Taiwan free, democratic, consensual, and somebody about whom it's not certain, that just, as noted, just might be willing to cut a deal. And that's what's at stake, regardless of who wins. There's going to be, I think, I don't know if chaos is the right word, but it's going to be unsettled. Because if Madam Tsai wins, Beijing is going to go berserk, and the threats, the bullying is really going to reach a sort of a very scary level. If the KMT wins, there's a good chance that they will sort of, through backroom dealings and sort of shenanigans, try to move Taiwan closer to China. And most people under the age of 40, almost over under 50, are not going to go for that. So you could have some sort of domestic unrest, so regardless of what happens. So it's going to be interesting in January. I don't think people quite people outside can quite imagine just how rough it could get.
Interesting. Well, let's somewhat tangential to that. Thoughts on what's going on in Hong Kong? Was the Chinese central government playing nice to get beyond the 70th anniversary? And now, with evidently increased troop levels in Hong Kong, that this thing will be brought to an end? Get out your crystal ball and tell us what's going to happen.
Central government has been playing nice, I think, only in the sense that they haven't gone in for sort of mass killing. That they have been, through their sort of their puppets in Taiwan, or in Hong Kong, which is the really the Hong Kong police force, can't be viewed as anything more than that. Really, it is the arm of the Chinese Communist Party, and it's no longer what it was. So they have been, sort of playing rough, a lot of beatings, a lot of arrests. A lot of police in protester garb causing provocations. And they have been playing rough, but not gone in for the Tiananmen Square, the sending the troops, sending the People's Armed Police in. But my guess is that what's going to happen, I think for the next month or two maybe, is that they're going to try and see if the protests burn themselves out. The schools have started again. And, you know, they've been going on for, 16, 17 weeks now, four months maybe. And people, kind of, it's just hard to keep up momentum. So I think the central government in Beijing is going to try to sort of see if it burns itself out, loses momentum, meanwhile keeping up the pressure, the quiet arrests, that sort of thing. And then if it does keep going, if it does, then I think you just might see a sort of a violent crackdown by the, probably by the PLA's or the Chinese People's Armed Police, which is a very aggressive, well-armed, paramilitary force, effectively. And they've got troops and hardware in place already, and they can do that anytime they want. A couple things to consider is that I think some smart money or some observers think that that Beijing sees all of this as entirely, it's a little paradoxical. They see it as entirely caused by foreigners. China's the Communist Party does tend to blame any problem on foreigners because everyone knows the Chinese Communist Party is so splendid that it couldn't possibly get anything wrong. Therefore, foreigners are to blame for anything. So But at the same time, there is a sense and awareness that, well, people are unhappy only because it's so expensive to live in Hong Kong if you're from there. You know, with property prices having tripled in a decade and rents going up and wages not going up, they think that is the underlying cause. And if they address those, that'll fix things. But if they don't, if that doesn't fix things, because those things are hard to address, then it's going to be the fault of Westerners. And if you go in hard and crack down, well, from Beijing's perspective, well, it's justified because foreigners are to blame. And also that no matter what Beijing does, these foreigners who are trying to contain China they'll never be placated, so might as well go in and do it. So I would say that after maybe a month or two, let's see what happens. And at that point, I think the possibility of a violent reaction, a violent suppression, it may go up as time goes on, assuming the protests continue as they are. I think it has surprised some people, even me a bit, that they have continued and not burned out. So they are sure the protesters are showing sort of a lot of energy, and they really don't, you know, have a lot of options. If you're, you know, a 20-year-old or younger, even Hong Kong person, what do you think? What's the future going to be? Rule by Beijing is not attractive. We've been surprised. I've been surprised before. I think we all have. So we'll see how it goes. But I think another month or two before you see a real crack, a Tiananmen Square-like, or using the police, the military, to crack it down, crack down. And once again, this is all speculation. I think it's not going to go on forever. And I think one thing that really, it's an anecdote, but it's something that does make a difference, is you saw some of the protesters put down pictures of Xi Jinping, the Chinese dictator. They put a lot of these photos on the ground of him, and people are walking over him. Dictators, they don't even like jokes. Xi Jinping doesn't like, it's against the, if you refer to him as Winnie the Pooh, I guarantee the secret police will be there.
That's all it takes?
He does look like Winnie the Pooh.
I know, but actually, how about if you said Christopher Robin's friend?
Well, they who knows?
would they pick up on that? I'll tell you what's interesting, Grant, is one, the level of organization of the opposition, the size that it swells to on relatively short notice, and the technological sophistication and some of the technological innovations that have been kind of pioneered. I was reading that there's a Bluetooth app that when they gather, if you have this app on your phone will receive messages from whatever you've tapped into, and it will then broadcast them to people around you. And so it's this Bluetooth network, short-range network, that they use to communicate. And very interesting, some of the innovations. I first read it, I was like, what? How could phones talk to each other unless through their network, and that network's monitored and can be shut down? And they said, oh, but no. You know, there's technology now that uses Bluetooth to communicate, and you would be passing somebody else's message, but you're part of that network. And so very, very fascinating. I'm with you. I mean, I'm extremely impressed, one, with their tenacity, and two, with, it seems like they've thought this through. They've thought that, hey, we're going to do this and they're going to do this. And then, so what it means is we can't just shut down the airport. If we do shut down the airport, we'll arrive, we'll descend on it, we'll disrupt its operations, and then we'll leave. Because to stay is to invite death. And they seem to be, in that way, kind of a step ahead. And I would dare say they've anticipated the little green men. And I think it's a very interesting little war that's going on in Hong Kong right now.
I agree. I was just thinking that, like today or yesterday, that it isn't, how do they manage to operate and have a sort of an organization within the, well, that certainly that will bring out tens or hundreds of thousands of people. How do they manage to do that in the face of really the world's most oppressive and effective surveillance state? It's really quite something that they've done it, and how they do it. I'm not an IT guy, to say the least. But that is something that really gets your attention, because in so many other places, say Iran, Russia, and mainland China, that the world's never seen anything like this in terms of using technology to suppress and oppress people. And so people in Hong Kong have done something that one has to be impressed. So we'll see how long it goes. But it is It's certainly something that is noticed in Taiwan, even if you don't read about it so much in the papers, because what's in store and what's going on in Hong Kong and what Hong Kong has in store for it, why exactly would anybody in Taiwan want to accept Chinese domination, servitude, and control?
Oh, my God.
I think Hong Kong has probably done more to improve the prospects for the Taiwan's incumbent president than anything the United States has done. I think the people in Hong Kong getting in the streets and to protest for freedom, demand it, and to be treated the way they have by both local Hong Kong authorities and by Beijing, that has, I think, has shifted voting preferences and support for the respective candidates, say, more than anything Washington's done.
Right. Let me one other question about the 70th anniversary of the birth of the China as we know it today. How pissed are they that the narrative that they wanted the world to see was obscured? The Great Parade was obscured by protests in Hong Kong. I would think that would have been, we planned this son of a bitch for 5-10 years. And now those assholes in Hong Kong, you know, the leading stories around the world were of protests in Hong Kong, not of the Great People's Parade in Beijing. I would think they'd be rip shit at that.
Yeah, I would think so. This was all supposed to be really just going from triumph to triumph right by now, and yet you look at how Beijing has stumbled with the trade war, the public criticism, condemnation of their treatment of Uyghurs, the Muslims, in East Turkestan, the western part of what China is occupying. That this is not, and then Hong Kong, you know, this is really has detracted from the splendor of the of the event. But nonetheless, what you did see, it's by any measure, one had better be scared. Take it really seriously. I think it did succeed in, I think, getting across the extent to which the Americans in particular, but the free world, the civilized world, has spotted China too many runs. They have allowed them to really develop into a formidable, indeed, I would say, scary military opponent. And the military is just the front end of sort of a regime that is bent on regional and world domination.
That sounds like a James Bond movie, right? Like,
you know, unfortunately, it is. You know, as I say, I don't know of a nicer way to put it, but, you know, I was watching this, you know, you watch that parade and you see what they've got on display. Plus, if this is what you do, like, all the time, which is what I do, and have been for probably 15 years now, is to give very close attention to what China is doing, what it has in mind. You watch this and, you know, you shake your head and say, this was obvious 15, 20, even 30 years ago. And we just sat by and watched it happen. And now instead of having like this 8-year-old who had bought the bodybuilding course that you'd laugh about, people who knew better laughed about, now you've got the 22-year-old who's been lifting every day. And this is a problem. I mean, our work is cut out for us if we want to avoid domination.
Interesting. I want to ask you about, speaking of that, John Bolton just spoke in public. I want to talk about Chinese amphibious Navy and its development, but John Bolton just made similar comments that we failed to heed. You know, he quoted Churchill talking about, you know, we had an opportunity in, you know, the early and the mid-1930s to deal with Germany, and we chose not to do that. And history is a hard taskmaster. What would have cost us thousands of lives in the mid-30s wound up costing the world 5% of its population, to the tune of between 75 and 85 million people of all causes after the war and the dislocation of people and disease and starvation and whatnot. so interesting. I'm curious. Bolton, in his speech at CSIS on Monday, you know, talked about, you know, the metric to for engagement relative to North Korea should not be whether we sit down and have a summit with them. It should be whether we make any tangible progress to get them to embrace, as Gaddafi did, this concept of ceasing their nuclear program. Did you watch or read any of his comments, and if you did, your thoughts on them?
I just read some of the summaries, and right. I think he's on target. I don't want to use the word uncompromising, but he knows, he's got ideas, and he's intelligent, and I think he's basically correct, unfortunately. Losing him was I've heard some people refer to it as a national tragedy. I thought it was very good to have him in the administration, because as I say, in any debate, he's done more homework than anybody there. And I think his ideas of how the world works and how one deals with threats to freedom, I think he's right. And it's a little depressing to hear, to hear him sort of describe the state of affairs, but difficult, that bad, and I think the 1930s comparison is not far off, unfortunately. We are where we are. And with North Korea, it is unfortunate we got sidetracked from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, when the South Korean President Moon thought he was going to fix things with North Korea and invited them to the Winter Olympics. That really threw what the U.S. was doing off track, and the Americans really had little choice but to say, oh, okay, go ahead and give it a try. And it's gotten us, I would think you'd have to say at this point, pretty much nowhere. Certainly the North Koreans, I don't think they're any more willing to cut a deal. The Chinese are providing support to North Korea just as much as they ever did Russians too. And so, unfortunately, I think we've lost coming up on 2 years worth of an opportunity to make progress. So I think John Bolton is correct about that. And this administration, it's not as if you still don't have people in the administration. Mr. Trump has some excellent Asian advisors, and they understand what ends up. That does give one comfort that there are people around Mr. Trump who do know how things work and who have a very clear understanding of what the situation is and with North Korea. But John Bolton is, his statements, when he talks, it's like the old E.F. Hutton commercials that people listen, or at least they ought to. The chatter parts of the commentariat, that they despise him, and they always have. But once again, when I use that expression, losing him was a national tragedy. I'm inclined to agree with that. You just can't afford to have people with such a clear understanding of what America's interests are and what needs done. And as I said, who have done their homework beyond a master's degree at SAIS and a semester abroad in Paris in their junior year. I think Bolton is very good, and it's, when he talks, you do well to listen and pay attention. If he could tell me if the Nationals or the Senators are going to win the World Series, I'd be even more impressed. Within the foreign affairs community, and he is, as I said, he's well resourced. He's one of the good ones.
Have we gotten distracted by the trinkets of meetings and the hermit kingdom, and have we mistaken this very superficial dance we're doing for some kind of progress? But, because we have talked on this, talking to Mr. Kim, it's better than him shooting ballistic missiles over the Japanese continent. But, I mean, have we been seduced to, to dance with him and under that protective cover, he continues to thwart sanctions. He continues to develop his nuclear program. And is that simply the path that he now, you know, will follow? And America, we somehow are less confrontational because we're talking a little bit. But he, and Bolton said this in his comments at CSIS, he said, you know, and it's a program that they will not give up freely. He said, make no mistake about that. They will not give this program up freely. You have to make them give it up. And there are UN Security Council resolutions condemning their use and calling for them to cease developing ballistic missiles. He said, look, that's Security Council stuff. That means Russia and China participated in that. You know, blah, 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 blah. So have we been seduced?
I don't know. That may not be the right word, because I think even the people who are favored talking, I don't know how much they actually expect. I think in some of previous administrations, Republican and Democrat, I think the word seduced is probably the right word, combined with hubris in a sense, well, if I can just get in the room and talk to them, they'll do what we want. And there's been any number of diplomats, administration officials who thought that. But I think there is a realization that it's a long shot, to say the least, that North Korea is going to voluntarily give up their weapons. But I would look at it more with this administration, especially given the people that have been responsible for North Korea policy. I think it's more a sense of, well, you might as well play the ball where it lies, because that's where we found ourselves once South Korea, the South Korean president, decided to sort of try to pull a Jimmy Carter try to make friends with the North. And once they were so happy to be friends, they were going to cooperate. He gave that a try. It hasn't worked.
Right.
But the problem was, when the South Korean president started that effort, if America had just said, forget about it, that, given the way that this president, the South Korean president, is, I think he is anti-American, and around him are some people who are scarily anti-American, it just might have caused a sort of a rupture in the U.S.-South Korean relationship, which that probably would have been worse than trying to let him go ahead with it and, you know, even talk to North Korea and see what comes of it. So it was a difficult position for this administration when that happened. And I think they've played the ball where they found it, and and I don't think they expected much, and they haven't gotten much. But this has been like a really lengthy discourse on using the word seduced. I wouldn't be inclined to use that word, but I think it's unfortunate we've lost so much time, the option now is to crank up the pressure, but you've reached a point at which the Chinese and the Russians probably are not even going to go along superficially, even superficially, and then you've got the distraction of all the, really this ongoing, continuous effort to destroy and undermine the results of a free election. And by that I mean the attacks which are continuing about on President Trump. This is effort and that is being applied to something not very useful. And when we're on the verge of really losing our position, losing a war, if there is one out in Asia. I don't see much progress being made on the North Korea front.
Okay. I want to ask you about something else that he discussed that's troubling. And I read it last week, and, you know, I think we're all familiar with the Japan-South Korea contentious, or their unease with each other over the Second World War. The whole idea of Korean comfort women and the whole Japanese thing about apologizing and whatnot. I don't think we're as familiar, and Bolton talked about it, as with a treaty that they signed in like 1965 that said, you know, what's in the past is, you know, we will, you know, somehow or the negotiate. I don't know what the treaty is, but we're not as familiar with that. And then Bolton talked about a GSOMI agreement which is the joint sharing of intelligence information between Japan and South Korea and the United States and whatnot, that there somehow has been a rupture in that agreement. And then last week it was that the South Koreans sent federal police or some agency to islands that they dispute with Japan. And Bolton's comment was, the United States has got to get knee-deep in this, ass-deep in this, and we've got to straighten this thing out, because our two primary, you know, partners in you know, the Central Pacific and Northwestern Pacific, you know, can't be at odds with each other like this, or it jeopardizes really the franchise that we need to sustain in order to maintain a front against not only North Korea but China in the region. Could you explain some of that to us?
I'll give it a try. Okay, the treaty that was between China and South Korea was reached in 1965. Japan and South Korea. Thank you. And the idea was to settle all claims and disputes between the two countries arising out of the Japanese colonization of South Korea. So Japan owned South Korea, or took South Korea as a colony, from, I think, 1905 until the end of World War II, so 1945, roughly. And this was to sort of reach an agreement between these two independent states that would say it was going to resolve everything and put the past behind them. The Japanese handed over a lot of money, such as they had in 1965, and to the South Korean government. And the South Korean government said, okay, we got it. That takes care of all our claims. The South Koreans have routinely trotted up the idea that the agreement wasn't a good one. It was unfair. It didn't address everything. And so it should be reopened and Japan should pay more money in addition to giving endless apologies. You know, it's never quite enough. So the Japanese feel, look, we reached an agreement, and you agreed it was okay, and we did the best we could at the time. Why do you keep reopening this when we had a formal agreement? And the South Korean administration, this is not the first administration, have actually used this as a tool to sort of harass and torment Japan, but also to create some support domestically in South Korea. Because there's this widespread dislike of the Japanese, a resentment, put it that way. And any good demagogue can always wield that resentment. And that's what the South Korean administrations do. This one is aggressively doing it. And just in the last few years, the Japanese and the South Koreans reached an intelligence sharing agreement called the GSOMIA, so don't worry about what it means, but you said it right. They agreed to share intelligence directly between each other rather than each passing it to the Americans, who would pass it along. That obviously, it saves time if you do it that way, is one thing. Plus, you, from American perspective, you know, if these two countries are cooperating with each other, that's a good thing. It might even lead to more cooperation. And the South Koreans have threatened, or have said they're going to cancel that agreement and go back to the old way of the Americans being the go-between, because they're so angry at the Japanese for fill in the blank. Take your pick of the imagined grievances. So from the American perspective, you know, they have been trying hard to get the two countries, the militaries and the governments, to cooperate. The dislike, particularly on the South Korean side, it manifests itself now and then, and we go back. You know, it's one step forward, one step back at best, maybe even more steps back. And so that's kind of, and the question is, and that John Bolton was referring to is, well, why aren't the Americans, as you use that expression, knee deep? Why aren't they right in the middle of this playing the role of marriage counselors? And one, I would suggest that America probably is doing more than we think, but it is a fair question, I think. And ultimately, you know, we've got an ambassador in South Korea, Admiral Harris, who used to be the PACOM commander, PAC Fleet commander.
Right.
He's the ambassador. And, you know, that's something that, you know, if you're the guy in charge, I think one fairly asks, why aren't things better? And, you know, one hopes that at the embassy, the ambassador level, that they've done everything they're supposed to do. And at the end of the day, one either produces or gets results or you don't. So I'm a little curious about how much we've done. And I think America could do more to sort of butt heads here particularly with the South Koreans. It's not easy, but at the same time, it's sometimes even a little public. Being a little more public about what you're doing can be very useful. I've sort of explained things a little bit, but and if you ask, well, who's to blame? I'd have to blame it on the South Koreans, and I think their behavior towards Japan really has been unreasonable. Not to say Japan is blameless, but I think the South Koreans, it's this resentment that brews up whenever a South Korean administration wants it, and they use it to sort of upset the bilateral relationship between Japan and South Korea. And it's, you know, we're the ones who are going to be dying for both countries, and we're the ones who guarantee their freedom. And it's not helpful to have one party, really the South Koreans, sort of acting like really angry five-year-olds. So there, that would be how I would assign the blame here.
Is it for domestic consumption inside of South Korea, and it's kind of got out of the, you know, in the three ring circus of South Korean politics, or however many rings there are, we whip this into a frenzy, right, for political reasons, but we really don't, you know, want to confront Japan over it. You know, we just want to get elected and stay in power, and that way we'll control the money and our friends will, everybody will be happy. Is there something of substance between the two nations other than, you know, this long simmering hatred that I think all of us that have deployed there have experienced? If you ever get into a serious discussion with the South Vietnamese, with the South Koreans, and the subject of Japan comes up, they certainly don't run from it. They don't hide their sentiment at all. I remember as a lieutenant, we hate the Japanese. We would like to fight them in a war. What? What? Yeah. And so, is it anything more than just domestic political consumption?
No. You know, at the end of the day, when you consider what's at stake and what America is expected to do for South Korea and has done, and there really is not much of a case the South Koreans have, any more than I would suggest reopening that agreement General Grant and Robert E. Lee made at Appomattox, because it was obviously unfair. There's about as much of a basis for South Korean complaints as there is for what those Yankees did to those of us who were born south of the Mason-Dixon line. The point is not much, if any. And it really is just, you know, done for, I think, demagogic, there's two things, demagoguery, which is, you know, when you have, say, an administration like this one in South Korea that was elected claiming it was going to fix the economy, and that's a huge issue in South Korea that doesn't get much attention. Their economy has been in bad shape for at least the last 7 or 8 years, and you have youth unemployment is a huge problem, and just the overall economy, and people are not, their lives have not gotten better. And that is what will turn a populace against an administration more than anything. And that is a lot of what is behind the distraction here. But there's something else, and that is that within the South Korean society, that there is a chunk of it, and particularly in the political class, that is very much anti-American and sees the Americans as the problem that keeps North and South Korea apart. And the idea is, well, if you get rid of the Americans, then South Korea and North Korea can work it out. And if you cause trouble with the Japanese, well, that's something, you sort of roil the relationship. That's a good thing. And that doesn't get the attention it deserves, but there is very much a strain of anti-Americanism in South Korea's ruling class. Now, if you go and visit South Korea, you won't notice it, but right. There is the, it's sort of the way you would find it on an Ivy League campus in the faculty lounge.
Right. It's very different from what you see around other places.
Yeah, that's how I see it. And right. That's is part of the equation, which doesn't get the attention it deserves. So, I do think that a lot of this is being done for domestic purposes. And then there is this undertone of, if the Americans are gone, everything will be better. Needs to be kept in mind. But you could play this, what I've just said, to all sorts of people in South Korea, and it would come back to, you don't understand. These Japanese really are evil. You just don't understand. We were colonized, blah, blah, blah. You can, just the way, say, Irish people would complain about Oliver Cromwell in the 17th century. At some point, you've got to get over this stuff. If you want to have any sort of a decent existence, that would be my take on it.
All right.
So, I'm not in a room full of South Koreans, so I can.
I can assert my own opinion. I want to ask you about in the news again were pictures of big deck Chinese amphibious warships being launched and stories about others under production. The ability of China to produce them rather quickly, the fact that there were even larger ones than the big decks they're showing us on the drawing board. China's amphibious capability, more future than present. Talk to me about, give me your thoughts about their amphibious fleet that looks strikingly a lot like ours does, the power projection business, that is truly the mark of a world power. Can you give them a grade? And I would think Taiwan would be very, both Taiwan and Japan would be very interested about those capabilities.
Oh boy, this is cheering me up. But Well, there's nothing to worry about because they haven't fought a war in 70 years, and the United States spends more in defense than the next six countries combined. Our armed forces are the strongest in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How often have you heard that? A lot, and I've even heard it within the Marine Corps. And I warned about this stuff for, years ago, and was told I didn't know what I was talking about. This is serious. And it's just one part of an impressive, scary military buildup. Now, speaking specifically about the amphibious capability, you laid it out as you usually do, so it makes it pretty easy for me. They built something. It's about, you think about, say, the Wasp, like an L-8,
whatever. I can never keep them straight.
Yeah, well, it's a big deck. It's like the Wasp or right. One of the big ones. And they built it in something like 9 months. And I think I'm throwing in a few months just to be on the safe side. For us, we couldn't. It would take us, probably 10 years to even figure out what color we were going to paint it.
Right.
But they laid the keel and boom, it was in the water like that. And they've been cranking out ships, say, for the last decade. At least for every one we put out, they've been doing three or four, roughly. And over time, that adds up. So, but they've built what is effectively a very good amphib. They've got a number already. They have some old ones, some newer ones, but this is the big one. And say it's going to be like Bonhomme Richard, the Wasp, that sort. And here's where I would see the big issue, the big concern is really not so much a Taiwan scenario, because China already has enough to hammer Taiwan and probably get a lot of troops ashore and see how it goes. And I don't know that these ships will really upset the balance in that regard. But what I would see as the bigger problem is, you know how for 50, 60 years it's been the U.S. Marine, U.S. Navy, the MUARG, the Marine Expeditionary Units, the Amphibious Ready Groups, that have been sailing around Asia, you know, showing the colors, showing the flag, conducting exercises, and really demonstrating U.S. power presence and even building a bit of influence.
Right.
It's been an American show. It is just a question of time before there are Chinese MUARGs making the rounds in Asia. And that's just for starters. It's going to go beyond Asia.
Right.
You're going to see them in the same place as we do.
Right.
We operate. You know, what happens when the Chinese MUARGs show up in South America, start making the rounds in Africa, the Mediterranean. That's coming. Now, one can just do the math. They could put together a sort of a MUARG right now if they wanted and sail it around and do stuff. And so it won't just be an American show. And then what happens when there's these Chinese units coming, sailing around, and they show up and they want to do exercises and nobody's going to say no. And they start having RIMPAC, like a Chinese RIMPAC in Asia. And once again, the invitation is delivered with armed guards who are willing to use their weapons. So nobody's going to say no to the Chinese. And by definition, that reduces America's position, its presence in the region, and its influence in the region. So just wait for that to happen. And so that's the outside of Taiwan scenario.
How about the humanitarian assistance? Instead of just the Americans calling with their ARG and ships, we have dueling capabilities.
To be
wonderful ambassadors around the world.
You said it. Remember how after I think it was 2013, Typhoon Haiyan, or the one in the Philippines?
Yes.
China got, they were, everyone laughed at them because they weren't able to respond. You know, they didn't know what to do, didn't have any ships or the know-how to get involved. And even the Japanese got involved, and people laughed at them. But, you know, you could see this and you say, well, okay, they're going to figure out what they need to do and they're going to do it. And you are going to start seeing a Chinese response to HADR operations akin to what the Americans have done and taken and been the leaders on. It's going to be a Chinese show. So in this battle for influence, that the Chinese amphibious force is going to be, it's something that is going to give us a run for our money, which is not good. And then another thing you're going to see is historically that every now and then the local Chinese population, say in Indonesia, it's been a while, but Malaysia can happen. But Indonesia in particular, in the South Pacific, the Southwest Pacific, that the local Chinese populations have been attacked by the local populace because they get angry for whatever.
Ooh.
And now the Chinese have not been able to do anything about it. Now you're going to see Chinese MUARGs showing up and throwing their weight around to protect overseas Chinese populations. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but you know, wait a couple of years, and I think we'll be surprised what we see on the amphibious front. So it's not just the Taiwan thing, but really it's think of how America uses its amphibious forces. I think you'll see the Chinese starting to do something similar to what we do, and that's. If China was Canada, I wouldn't really mind. It'd be okay. Or if it was the British Royal Navy getting on its feet again, that would be fine. But, you know, this is an aggressive totalitarian regime bent on domination, and amphibious forces are a wonderful tool for exerting one's influence.
So more of the extortion, just actually another arm to extend the extortion and promote China's extortion the way it does business. Hey, look, you want us, you know, you'll receive our ships, you know, we'll tie it to, you know, taking more of your exports. All ships will rise, you'll stay in power, do business with us. Leave the Americans out of it.
That's a good way to put it. There is that angle to it. You know, if anyone does sort of resist, well, their coal shipments to China suddenly start, the ships have to sit offshore. They can't unload them. Bananas, say, from the Philippines start, they leave them on the docks because of health issues. There's all sorts of ways to lean on a country, and China's, of course, willing to do it. And the amphibious capability is really what you want. This is probably 8 or 9 years ago. I saw in a Chinese, I can't find it, of course, but in a Chinese periodical, I read the translation, and it was somebody saying, they said, aircraft carriers are good, but what you really want are amphibious ships. And they laid out all the reasons that you or I would think of. And it was that they've understood the usefulness of amphibs it's not retaking because the PRC has never had Taiwan, beyond grabbing Taiwan. That it's really the ability to influence, to have a more or less more regular, constant presence than would otherwise be the case in the region and worldwide. And so we'll see how it goes. Fortunately, they do have some vulnerabilities in China, and particularly, as we've discussed before, the economic vulnerabilities and their dependence on the U.S. and foreign investment and the dependence on exporting things to earn convertible currency. So there are some, some weaknesses that we would do well to capitalize on.
That wasn't a very optimistic assessment of so the American, the Commandant's new guidance comes off the decades-old Marine Corps plank of 38 amphibs to move two brigade-sized expeditionary units separately, blah, 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 blah. Our response to greater Chinese movement is, I'm not sure. Is a more agile joined with the Navy response. What does that mean? I don't really know.
I thought it was good to end the fixation on this particular number of a certain type of amphib. There's a lot of ships around, and our allies have 50 plus of them. There's ships you can use, and either ours or our allies. And I thought the guidance was smart to take advantage of the geography in the Asia region, which is very well suited for smallish marine units moving around fast, hard to locate, and particularly using long-range precision weapons, right. Particularly anti-ship missiles that you can hide them in shipping containers, of which there's only millions of them, or in fishing boats. There's all sorts of ways you can make yourself a tough target, but have the ability to really close off large stretches of the map through which Chinese forces would have to move. So I thought the guidance had some very good things in it, and particularly the focus on Asia after so many years in the sandbox. And I noticed several times when MARFOR PAC commanders would go to Washington for the general officer get-togethers, and they'd come back and say, nobody was interested in Asia. They should have been, because unfortunately during that time, an enemy that could defeat us in certain circumstances was allowed to sort of get its footing. So we'll see, see how the guidance plays out, or if it sticks. We will see how that works. I'd like to think so, because it is a region perfectly suited for the Marines to play an important role.
If a war comes to the South China Sea, if shooting starts, what happens? I mean, it's a naval and aviation confrontation, yes? How does that play out?
Well, one way to people could probably write books about it, but the one couple things to keep in mind is the economic knock-on effects of any shooting down there. If you want to see a stock market go down 20,000 points in an afternoon, that's what it would be. If you want to see international trade stop, that's what's going to happen. And nobody quite thinks through what is going to happen once the first shot is fired. And I say the knock-on effects, ripple effects.
Right.
That is an interesting topic. I'm actually going to be talking about it tomorrow here in Taiwan. But in terms of how you'd fight it, one thing that, and looking at it from the Marine perspective, is, you know, suppose in World War II, you know, if you say that the Coast Watchers, you know, these brave Australians, who sort of hid on islands in the Southwest Pacific, and would give advance notice of Japanese aircraft and ships going by, and also rescue downed pilots and sailors, like President Kennedy, but if you suppose the Coast Watchers had been armed with anti-ship missiles, it would have made things, maybe some very long afternoons for Japanese ships trying to transit through those straits. And also aircraft-wise, you can do some good work down there also. And if they had had anti-submarine weapons. The point being with the way the geography is that you have so many islands, archipelagos, and very narrow sort of sea space, that with the right units in the right places and moving around and with the right kind of weapons could very easily sort of block off Chinese access eastwards into the Pacific, and that is how I see the marine part of all this would play out, effectively helping the maneuver of naval and air forces by sort of marine presence on these some of these islands with the right weaponry. So that would be part of it. That I think is probably the better way to play it. If the idea is of, say, U.S. task forces sailing into the South China Sea, and, you know, going toe-to-toe with the Chinese, and don't forget Chinese land-based missiles that can hit the ships, I would not be inclined to bet on our prospects for successful engagement there. That would not have a happy ending. So we are going to have to think about how we want to fight this thing and not fight it the way the other side would want. You know, ideally, we won't fight, but because, boy, if we do, the results will be, as I say, beyond just the immediate casualties and damage, the effect on the world. It'll be something akin to when the Russians invaded Poland with the Germans in 1939. That's unfortunately, that's what I think it'll, the results will be. It'll differ in the specifics, but not in the fact that everybody, that all of us are going to notice the effects. Be my sense of it.
But as I look at the map, and I'm not Clausewitz, mind you, or General Krulak, the senior, or Pete Ellis, okay, I'm not any of those people, but you can isolate China. No,
it looks that way. Yeah,
you look at the map, and we have, and I remember I had General Tulin on a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, China's trying to, you know, to use a sports, a football term, you know, you contain an offense, right? He said, well, we've contained. He said, if you look at the map, we've contained China, and they're trying to break that contain. Their Belt and Road. You know, the work they do around the world, trying to find other ways to bodies of water. But all that could be easily contained by the United States and our allies. And so it is interesting that let's just say we don't use the Straits of Malacca and the Malaccan Straits, and that shipping that's going from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific now has to go, you know, south of Sumatra, and then, you know, past Darwin and Australia, and then the Pacific that way. Yeah, it adds a couple days, but you know what? Does world commercial, other than punishing the Chinese, you know, does world commercial commerce stop because of that? No, it's marginally affected, right? But we could shut all we and our allies could shut all of that off to everything. And so I know, you know, so it would be interesting, you know.
You do have to get your act together in peacetime. Do right. what's necessary to right. ensure that you can control and operate from the key terrain.
Right.
And notice how we've been back-footed in the Philippines. There's some real questions as to whether or not we would be allowed to operate there. That's a problem. The importance of Taiwan becomes very clear. The Chinese got the sort of diplomatic recognition from the Solomon Islands at the expense of Taiwan just a week or two ago.
Right.
What if there's a Chinese base in the Solomon Islands? What if there's one in East Timor? What if there's some other places beyond the first and second island chains? And, you know, over time, they reestablished such a presence, such a sort of a regularity to their operations out there that they've effectively leapfrogged the containing island barriers, the first and second island chain. So the point is that in peacetime, you better do what's necessary. And unfortunately, I don't think we have. We've squandered opportunities in this regard. It's not too late, but you know, baseball terms, bottom of the seventh and we're down by six might be one way to look at it. But you know, I think you've laid it out, I think, quite nicely. Though, you know, I'm a little pessimistic as to how far we've let things drift. It's not too late, but it's going to be much harder to recover from than it needed to be.
Interesting. All right, sir. What's the next thing you're writing? When will we see it? And where will we see it?
I think I've got something about Jack Ma and Alibaba.
Oh.
You know, he's the the most well-known Chinese businessman, his company Alibaba, that, you know, there's been a lot of oohing and aahing about him, which perhaps is not as well-deserved as it should be, but as people think it should be. But the little piece tries to describe how you can be a private company in a communist system. And the point is that you can't really be. And to look at it as like these very brave entrepreneurs who managed to navigate and operate successfully in the PRC. But in fact, Jack Ma and Alibaba are effectively what you would think of as a state-owned private enterprise. And like all of these these well-known Chinese businessmen, they are only as successful and free and alive as the Chinese Communist Party permits them to be. So that's what I'm talking about. It's a little different, trying to offer a few insights into that question of, you know, how does it fit into a communist system? And I think that's, it's always been a little hard to grasp. So I tried to talk to some people who are smarter than I, which is it's a huge number, and write something up. And it should appear, I think, in AND magazine, AND magazine, I think pretty soon, maybe. Might have already, but certainly within the next few hours, I should think.
Interesting. All right, sir. First of all, as always, appreciate you staying up late, and congratulations on a big win by your Nationals last night. Wish them all the best of luck with that victory. They get to go out and face the number one team in the National League, the Los Angeles Dodgers. But it beats going home. So
the Dodgers are losers. They haven't been much since Sandy Koufax is with them.
I agree, and their critical vulnerability is their bullpen. They have marquee players all over the field, but the Nationals have pitching. In particular, they have starting pitching, and it was on display last night. And they're not bad in the bullpen either. And the Dodgers, if you get to their bullpen, they don't get it done down there. So I think the Nationals have a chance.
I think that you never know. You know, it's an interesting time of year, and it's always it's always fun, you know, to see, and particularly if you kind of have an interest in one of the teams. we'll see how it goes. You know, you just never know at this level. But though I have, I got to make a couple withdrawals from my IRA this morning. I'm telling you, this is the year.
Well, I hope you're old enough that you don't get penalized, because there's substantial penalties that go with that grant.
Not that old, so I'm paying the price. Well, so it's a sure thing.
That 28%, that's rough. I don't want to reignite this, but on a subsequent edition of this, I would like to litigate a shooting war in the South China Sea with you, and just discuss how that unfolds. Not the events leading up to it, but just assuming that the first shots get fired, then what? What happens as the world turns its attention? Well, it would have already had its attention in that area, but a shooting war with China, to me, I don't know. My first glance, and that's why I want to look at it now, because I'm intrigued, is that China's containable, and they're in a much more precarious situation than not as precarious as Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia. Because they would be substantially impacted, Vietnam in particular, substantially impacted by the South China Sea being blockaded. But I'd like to entertain that subject with you maybe the next time we talk.
Sure, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's different ways to look at it, and it's always useful to think through these things,
right,
particularly
right.
Some of the downstream effects. Of them. It'd be a good topic. I look forward to that.
Okay. All right, Grant. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Sure. Pleasure. Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
There you have it. The one and only Grant Newsham here. Always interesting. In my head I have I think like most people, you have a vision of the apocalyptic nature of war with, war with... war with China, right? You know, it goes dark. But you look at the map, and you say, okay, what's the sequence of events? And when you look at the map, China's screwed by the map. We're not. We can project power, and we have, and we don't fight to get away from our coast. They do. Okay? You can contain them. You have Taiwan. You have Japan. You have the Korean Peninsula. Right? You have Australia. You have the Philippines. China can be contained. And, and screw their Belt and Road initiatives around the world. The United States Navy... we can stuff our foot up that ass, right? So it's kind of interesting. And why would we even go into the South China Sea to fight? We don't need to. Just lay the wood to that bitch from outside of it. Right? Yeah, one of my genius friends just shot me a text. Right? The first shots would be followed by a cyber blackout and then followed by a GPS blackout, right? So we're going to fight World War II style. You can see as far as your AWACS, right? And once you radiate that son of a bitch, that thing becomes a target too. So then what? Right? Then who's got the advantage? To me, once the GPS gets blown out and the satellites get blown out, we have the advantage. Now, some people might say, well, not so fast, Sanchez. Maybe not. Interesting, right? Interesting. Maybe if we had done this before the Iraq War, maybe we would have had a more grown-up discussion about it, right? The war plan for Iraq said that if you don't get X number of troops into the country, that you're going to have a civil war. When you take the iron fist off these three factions that have coexisted in this quote unquote secular nation, it's going to get unsecular and it's going to get violent. What? Yeah. Maybe if we'd had and then you didn't have Donnie Rumsfeld, you know, writing his own war plan. Anyway. Yeah. Followed by DF-21s hitting everything within 1,000 nautical miles of the shoreline. Yeah. Now, again, those are all on fixed targets, right? Because now that you have your eyes poked out, it's like the whole hypersonic missile thing, right? If they want to shoot Mount Rushmore or the White House or the Capitol, and they can shoot it 1 billion miles away, and it goes 1 billion miles an hour, there's nothing you could probably do to stop that. Right? At least right now. Somebody will figure out a way to fuck that thing up. Trust me. It's the spiral of weaponry throughout our history. They will either jam the internal navigation system, they will do something, they will put up a pulse, they will find some way to knock shit like that out of the sky. Okay? So, I just saw a headline, B-52s now with supersonic weapons. So then the problem becomes target acquisition. How do you acquire how do you acquire a dynamic target like a ship? Well, you got to have another ship or an aircraft that's up, that's radiating, that finds that son of a bitch on radar. So you can rubbleize. Those atolls aren't worth shit. You can harass fishermen with them. Okay? I got it. You can make people's lives miserable in the South China Sea. But as soon as the shooting starts, those things are done, over with, right? Don't even bother putting in your earplugs, boys and girls, because you aren't gonna be around long enough to even worry about it. So don't worry about it. So yeah, those things are, you know, power projection into the South China Sea. Yeah, those things shoot something, they will be annihilated. And then what? You have marauding navies out at sea, you have air forces up in the sky, and you have submarines, right? You have submarines below the surface, all trying to relay target acquisition information so that you can whack stuff, because everybody's blind. So now what do you do with all these beautiful hypersonic weapons that I don't have a target for? I shoot them really quick against shorter range targets? Okay. Well, we got to use them. I mean, they are ordnance, for God's sakes. So, I mean, but to me, it's an interesting, you know, look at the map. Look at China. They got a problem, man. They're contained by geography. Right? They're contained by geography. I mean, honestly, the United States, talk about gifted geographically, two gigantic oceans and allies north and south. I mean, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. You know, that's pretty good. If you want to be a player in fact, if you looked at the world map, I'm looking at my Google Earth map. Pick another nation that has the geographic bounty that the United States has, and then has the magical fate of history, right? To drop a democracy that develops it in a way that no other nation's ever been developed. This experiment democracy, that it is geographically enough gifted. Now again, you look at South America. Right? You have Brazil. But Brazil is like China. They're on one half of the continent. Okay? The United States spans the continent. Like Wide World of Sports right here. Spanning the globe. The United States, right? Spans the continent. Manifest destiny. Right? I don't know that there's another nation in the world that has the geographical benefits that the United States has. In fact, I'll say it right now. There is no nation on this planet that has the geographical benefits that the United States of America has. None. I'm serious about that too. I'm straight up serious about that. Yeah. So I'm not afraid of them in the South China Sea. Fuck it, man. We don't need to go there. In fact, fuck the South China Sea. Yeah, remember when I had my, like, fuck the VA thing going? What's that NWA? That song, Fuck the Police, right? Yeah, I did a vote, my own version of fuck the VA. Anyway, I would say do that, a version of that with the South China Sea. Fuck that thing, man. We'll shut it down in the Indian Ocean, right? We'll shut it down on the south side of Sumatra, and we'll shut it down in the Philippine Sea. Yeah, have all you want inside that son of a bitch, because we're blowing everything we acquire up. Yeah, you know what that sound was? It's the sound of freedom, baby. That's right. Steel on target. Right? The sound of freedom. Yeah. Don't get confused. That's what it is. The, yeah. We don't need it. We could, hey, we can reroute that tanker traffic. Oh, yeah, you know, Singapore is going to be fucking pissed. Yeah. But, okay, you're not going to go through the Malaccan Straits. You're going to drop down south of Sumatra. Right? And then you're gonna go past, you know, Darwin, and then you're gonna hook up on the far side of you're gonna hook up on the west side of, what is that, New Guinea? Yeah. You're gonna hook into the Pacific Ocean there. And then you can transit to Japan and South Korea. Everything else is gonna wither on the vine. Wither on the fucking vine. Yeah. I got two messages. One, here's one. And the United States Navy is going to do this. Yeah, the fucking Navy's going to do it. Look, if we have to crew those bitches with Marines, we'll do that, all right? Here's and here's another one. Better get our Navy some training. No shit, man. Hey, those stupid son of a bitches, if they're not paying attention, then you're dumber than we all think you are. You're dumber than we think you are. Now the Navy's getting beat up. Holy shit, you just took us to war in the South China Sea. Well, I mean, like, what are we going to, like, so we're going to have companies of Marines and boats, like, zooming all over to be targets, I guess. Yeah, why not? What the hell? We could fight the Chinese down there. We could do that. But you know what? Big formations down there? No. They're just going to be Anglico teams. We're going to have companies of Marines acting as Anglico teams. We're going to be in support of the aviation element, right, and the naval element. Right? We'll be spotters for them as they blow the shit out of everything Chinese. Yep. We'll keep our destroyers and frigates and all our missile launchers on the east side of the Philippines, and then we'll launch the shit out of them. Right? Yeah, that's what we'll do. Boom, done. Mac solves the South China Sea. Fuck it. Fuck the South China Sea, man. We don't need it. Anyway, I love doing foreign policy, by the way. Something that I studied extensively in college. Yeah. All right, that'll do it. Hey, here's your task for today. Go fucking save somebody's life, man. Right? Keep your ears open. Find somebody who's struggling and look at them and say, hey, man, can I help you? And when they say, what do you mean? You say, you know what I fucking mean, man. You're fucked up as Hogan's goat. Sit down, I got something to say to you. One, there's nothing wrong with you. Two, you can do this. Three, you're not getting over it. Got it? Okay, shut up. Nobody said to talk yet. Yeah, that's what you say to them. And you save their fucking life, man. It's cool. It's cool. So, have a great day. Tomorrow, yeah, the Kenny and Lynch event happens. So, maybe I'll give them an assignment today. We'll talk about war in the South China Sea. What's it look like? Yeah, let's see what those two Mensas have to say. In about a week, I start about a month and a half of just ripping post-traumatic winning all over the planet, man. Yeah, I'm fired up about it, too. From Naomi in Alabama. Yeah. Trump always has an opening for his Secretary of Defense. That's right. No, look at a map, right? And the Chinese, they know it. You know, let me just tell you one thing that we don't really realize. We don't realize what a powerful nation we have and what a mature, powerful nation we have and what a mature, powerful military we have with infrastructure around the globe that supports all this power projection. Right? All over the world. And why does it work? Right? Because we come with a lot of money. And if you'll partner with us, you could probably do okay, too. Right, we're not perfect, I'm not going to say that, but, I mean, capitalism is the best economic system on the planet, right, among other shitty alternatives. That's why it survives. Hell, that's why it thrives. Anyway, so, yeah, look at the map, they're fucked. Interesting. So yeah, so we're gonna get into war in the South China Sea and blockading that bitch. What would it take, like two ships on the western end of the Straits of Malacca? Of the Straits of Malacca? Maybe three? Get the Royal Thai Air Force after anything that moves? In the Gulf of Thailand? Fuck. The war will be fought where geography doesn't matter. Ooh, this is kind of cosmic shit right here. Cyber, in space, commerce, EW. Well, the cyber war is already going on. We just don't participate. We're getting our ass kicked in it. You know, I had a friend that told me that all the money we spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that amount was stolen from the United States by the Chinese. Yeah, I had a friend tell me that once. Yeah, that war is already going on. The space war it ends quickly. And then it's simply a question of, do we have satellites, right, low-orbiting satellites that we can somehow or other protect that we can use? Stealth satellites. Bernie Sanders, he's on the shelf for a while. He had a heart procedure. Here's another one. Holy shit. That sounds halfway reasonable. We can shit kick the Chinese in the South China Sea. That's awesome, Mac. I'm going to sleep better tonight. Yeah, let me tell you, man, the Chinese ain't all that. It's like, oh, China, 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 China. Yeah, fuck them. They ain't all that. Yeah. Boom, bitches. That's right. Boom. They ain't. I mean, look at it. And then again, this whole, like, you know, to me, hypersonic weapons are my favorite, okay? And I've got to end this show here. But hypersonic weapons. Yeah, what happens when you move the target, like, a quarter mile? Not even that. And you're not monitoring the target. Well, where it was going to get shit blown up, right? But they don't have a dynamic targeting lock on that thing for a gazillion miles. They don't. It's not how it works. So once everybody goes dark, then you're going to fight World War II again. Yeah, open air cockpits when men were men. None of this closed canopy bullshit. Oh, yeah. That's where men were men. Here's another Mensa text, right? It'll be a union of China, Russia. I don't believe that. First of all, Russia, not worried about them. North Korea, not. What do they do once we turn the lights off? Like, hello? 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 Is anybody there? No, there's no. Sir? Winnie the Pooh? There's no dial tone from Korea anymore. The whole nation is dark. Well, it was dark to begin with, stupid. Oh, yes, sir, I know that. But it's like, the only five lights that are on are they're dark now. Oh. Iran? Really? Iran. Come on, man. Get real. Right? Iran is like a little guy bully. And the only reason they can't get put in its place is because the Saudis don't like to fight. They like people like other people to fight for them. So Iran's just like crazy person running around the neighborhood. Now, I'm starting to get hate from some of the pilots listening. Really, Mac? You're calling us pussies because we fly in a closed... I didn't say that. I didn't use that word, okay? But like I said, World War II, when men were men, open cockpits, right? Looking out the side of the aircraft. Oh, yeah. That's the Yamaguchi, or whatever the fuck the aircraft carriers we sank at the Midway, right? Let's go, boys. Let's man this shit up. And go make those son of a bitches pay. That's right. Those were naval aviators, my friends. Right? Flying those dauntless dive bombers, man. Holy shit. And besides, by the time we get to this fight, there will be no more Maverick and Top Gun. That will be a thing that you go see in a theater. They will be guys who wear their green Zoom bags, their little suits, right? With all their shit on them. And they'll be sitting in, like, modules in Tallahassee, right? Chewing their gum, right? All that bullshit. There won't be anybody in the plane anymore. And the reason that's going to happen is if you don't have anybody in there to protect, right, you can stealth it up and then shit can all the rest of those systems in there, right? Maybe you have one guy who controls 16 aircraft. Yeah. Crazy stuff. And then there's a bigger problem that two people just pointed out to me. Does that mean that the women stop coming to the O Club? I think it does. Okay? Because the video game dudes, right, the drone pilots, they're not the same macho guys that fighter pilots are, right? You talk to fighter pilots, man, right? And they, until they encounter grunts, they think they're like men. And then they encounter grunts and like, okay, all right, I'm not as manly as you guys are, but, right, I get it. until you guys show up, I'm pretty manly in this whole, okay, I will grant you that until we show up, right? You guys get to run amok. But if the United States tends to its alliances, right, in this case, in particularly to the Pacific, right, and the same thing in Europe, I mean, with Russia, what does Russia say if Germany and France would simply participate with NATO and have decent militaries? What does Russia say? There's not a fucking thing Russia says. Russia, remember, Russia has the size of an economy of Canada. That's why they can't have an arms race, because they can't afford one. We've got hypersonic missiles, two of them. Right? That's the game Dr. Evil plays. But let me tell you, when Dr. Evil dies and the next guy comes, there's going to be a day of reckoning, because Dr. Evil is like the grand faker of all times, because they ain't all that. They don't have a robust economy. They don't have a formidable military. They can fake it for a little while, like they did in Syria. But you start reading readiness reports that come out of people that monitor what the Russians are doing there, and they suck, man. They suck. The grunt jealousy is too obvious, even on the radio. Jealousy of what? Like the homoerotic volleyball game? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I mean, if that's your deal, then have at it. Just let's not get confused, okay? Because let me tell you what fighter pilots like the most. They like to go be grunts. They do. Like, as much as they like being fighter pilots, they love to go be grunts. It's pretty amazing to see. And I will say this, the good ones like being grunts and they take pride in it, right? And the good ones I know are they make good grunts and they love being grunts, right? It's kind of another manly event for them. And I don't hold that against it, right? But yeah, that's why I want to talk about the South China Sea now. I'm kind of interested, right? But if the United States tends to its alliances, right? At some point, this whole, like, you know, like, China's like the hottest, like, girl on campus right now. That, too, will pass, my friends. Because it's a totalitarian bullshit country. That's what it is. So, anyway, with all that said, with all that wisdom bestowed, with all that wisdom bestowed on everybody, and the second time I play Steve Winwood, I gotta get out of here. On a Wednesday. If you're just tuning in, John Bolton, you'll hear John Bolton in the first hour. You'll hear a little bit of the National League Divisional Wild Card Playoffs last night. Awesome game. Juan Soto singles in two runs. Would have scored, probably. The right fielder coming in to make a play. The ball moves on him. It hits something on the second bounce. You can see it. And it moves to his right, our left, as we're looking at it, in most shots. And three runs score. You'll hear that. You'll hear a guy who has predicted the winners of every presidential election since 1984. His name is, he's a professor at American University called Lichtman. Right? Not spelled L-I-C-K either, assholes. L-I-C-H-T-M-A-N. But he's been on, and he's, you know, he's talking about Trump and whatnot. Even with the, even with this kind of scandal thing checked, he says you need four for the opposing, you need six of 13 to be against the incumbent party for the challenging party to take over. Okay? All the rest of it's bullshit. You need at least a minimum of six of 13 factors to be against the party in power. And the scandal thing, if Trump is in fact impeached, would only be the fourth. You'd need two others to go against him in the next 18 months, 2 years. Coming up on 2 years. In a month. That's right. Yes or no? Is it 2 years? Yeah, it's 2 years. No, it's not. It's a year, right? We go to the polls a year from November. Yes. All right, now that I got that straight in my head. So you'll hear him. And then you hear John Bolton in his first remarks against since leaving the White House. And he said some interesting things about, are we being seduced by these very, very high visible talks with North Korea that are leading to nothing, which allow North Korea to continue to develop their weapons program and us not be as focused on the sanctions. We've stood down our major exercises on the Korean Peninsula, blah, 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 blah. So, you'll hear John Bolton. And then Brett Newsham joined us, and we talked about Hong Kong. We talked about Chinese 70th birthday and how much longer they'll go sideways in Hong Kong. We talked about Japan and South Korea, their historical disputes, the GSOMI agreement that evidently is in jeopardy, the treaty. They have a treaty, it's called like the regular treaty of 1965. That where Japan paid South Korea reparations. I don't know what you'd call it. And they said all this is in the past now. Well, South Korea said, maybe not so much. We might want to revisit that. So anyway, you'll hear Grant talk about that, and then we talk about the Chinese amphibious capability that they continue to grow. And then at the very end, we talk about war in the South China Sea. What's it look like? So, it's a fairly decent 2 hours. I would recommend it to you. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio. And as I said, it continues. Tomorrow, when Jeff Kenney, Tim Lynch will join me, and those two Mensas and I will discuss war in the South China Sea. We'll see if they know shit about it. And if they don't, trust me, it will not stop them from talking about it. That's one of the wonderful things about having those two geniuses as friends. So anyway, have a great day. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.